Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And summer is here, looking to be a busy one for everybody, including me. I'm headed back to the UK next month for the Jericho Chronicles. I'm telling stories, answering your questions. There's going to be different stories and different topics every single night. Tickets available now at itrtix.com. There are still a few VIPs left. Make sure to get yours now, July 4th in Glasgow, Scotland at SWG3, July 5th in Belfast at Limelight, and July 6th, London at The Grand. Get your tickets now at itrtix.com. We are going to have a grand old time. So make sure you join us once again, itrtix.com. Get your tickets and VIPs while you still can. And if you live in Canada or the States or Scotland, Ireland, Northern Ireland, England, Wales, Australia, New Zealand, you have a chance to come rock with Fozzy this fall. We're doing another round of dates on the Save the World Tour in 9 countries. And we start in the United States September 8th in Columbus, Ohio at the King of Clubs. FozzyRock.com is all the dates and ticket information, along with details on our legendary VIP meet and greets. We always play 5 songs for you. A pre-show concert. A pre-show show. And of course, we meet you, we greet you, we hang out with you, we sign some stuff. It is a great time. Don't forget, we start in the United States. We go to Canada. We're hitting Montreal and Toronto. Then we're headed down under once again, November, December, New Zealand and Australia. Fozzy is heading your way, kicking that tour off in Auckland, November 28th, hitting Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney, and Adelaide in Australia. And don't forget, once again, the UK tour starts in November. We are going across the entire country with Escape the Fate, one of our favorite rock and roll bands, and another huge band in their own right. It's going to be the biggest tour we've ever had in the UK, which has always been probably our best territory. And of course, that tour starts in November, as we start November 4th in Manchester at New Century Hall, Birmingham, Nottingham, Dublin, Belfast, Swansea, Bournemouth, Bristol, Glasgow, London. So many rock and roll shows. Go to FozzyRock.com for all ticket information and VIP details. All right, today on the show, making his single debut, he's part of the Jericho Appreciation Society, one of the foundations. Just had a killer main event match against John Moxley at the Forum in Los Angeles just a few weeks ago. And he's the guy who single-handedly brought back the Kangol hat. I'm talking about Daniel Garcia. You heard his story about how he joined the Jericho Appreciation Society, but now you're going to hear his entire career story, how he got started, where he trained, when he first made the Blade, aka Peppa Pox, details about his WWE tryout that did not go successfully, thankfully for us, when he signed to AEW as a result. He's got stories of the Buffalo wrestling scene, the indies, how he, Wheeler Yuta, and Lee Moriarty were able to make them name for themselves in the indies, even during the pandemic, and how he views his in-ring style and personality. Danny's also talking about the car crash that nearly ended his wrestling career and brought us together, as fate would have it. So we're going to be talking to the epitome of sports entertainment, Daniel Garcia, right here, right now, on Talk is Jericho. All right, so we had a critically acclaimed Talk is Jericho the other day with the Jericho Appreciation Society. And during that time, I realized that I hadn't had Daniel Garcia on. You called me out, and here you are, finally on your own.
I felt pretty disrespected that you didn't have me on the show. I was wondering when you were going to invite me, but it just never came. So I'm glad I'm finally here.
Well, there's lots to talk about, too, which we'll get into. But first of all, I mean, that we did the JAS one prior to the Anarchy in the Arena and prior to the great match you had with Mox the other night on Dynamite. So first of all, what did you think of Anarchy in the Arena? Let's discuss that, just the two of us.
Ooh, Anarchy in the Arena was an interesting night. Like, going into it, I wasn't really sure how it was going to go or necessarily what all the plans were for everything. But it's one of those matches, once you're doing it, like, you know it feels right.
Right.
Like, once I was in the moment and I was brawling in the concessions, I knew that we were part of something special. And seeing the aftermath, how it's been received, it's been really special for me.
Well, it's amazing, too, because, like you said, we didn't really know. I knew it would be good just because all of us are in it. We had kind of a cool, you know, skeleton for it. But I wasn't expecting it to be as crazy as it was. And the crowd was just going bananas. Like, I remember thinking, this is probably going to be hard if the crowd can't really see all the fighting. But they were into it all the way across the board.
It was exciting because when I went out, like, I heard Justin Roberts announce, like, this is Anarchy in the Arena, and the crowd erupted.
Yeah.
And I think right when I heard that, I thought, this is going to be a lot easier than I thought it was.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about your concession brawl, because Eddie was convinced, dead set on doing the Tupelo, Mississippi concession fight.
Eddie Kingston is a dog, man. So I give Ortiz those pile drivers on the stairs.
That looked great, by the way. That was
thank
awesome.
Thank you.
I didn't know what you were getting at when you said you wanted to do the move. I'm like, what does he want to do? And that was really cool.
Thank you. But I definitely underestimated the walk from the ring up into the concession stand.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh man, Matt's getting choked by that hanger. I got to go save him. So I start walking up, and about a quarter way up the stairs, I'm blown up. I'm breathing heavy. I feel like Rocky running up the stairs in Philadelphia. And then I get up there, and I just see a sea of people, like legitimately probably like 300-400 people in the concession stand area. And I'm with, I'm really good friends with one of the bodyguards, David here, Play. And he was.
Isn't that Ortiz's cousin?
Ortiz's cousin, yeah. He's been watching me beat his cousin up for a year and hasn't done anything about
it. Damn thing.
He was kind of right next to me, and he was saying to me, like, where are we going? Where are we going? And I just jetted through the crowd and jumped on Eddie, and the concession stand area went crazy. It felt like I was in like a cafeteria fight in high school.
And just a quick segue for people that don't know, David was actually in the motorcycle club that had a couple things with the Inner Circle, and then ended up becoming one of our top security guards here. So you never know. You never know when you get your chance. So it felt like you said, like a high school cafeteria fight.
That's what it felt like. I went to a school called Hutch Tech in downtown Buffalo. People were fighting all the time. And that brought me right back to high school. Just like jumping on Eddie Kingston while he's covered in ketchup and mustard and Matt's blood. I was like, man, this brings me back to the good old days of middle school and high school.
And of course, then, we always say that, like, oh, who cares about the star ratings or whatever? And for the most part, I don't. But when you see that we got the 5-star rating, that's pretty cool. Like, I was like, that's not easy to do. I think that's only my second after 32 years of these matches that I've had.
Yeah, I mean, once Matt told me yesterday, he texted the group chat and was like, yeah, I think we got a 5-star rating. I was in the hotel lobby with Jeff because we were going to that mixer thing. Yeah. And I got up and I started beating my chest. I got real excited because that's an accomplishment that when you grow up in my era of wrestling fans, like I grew up in like the internet wrestling community and star ratings and Meltzer, that was all very important to my generation of people. So once I found out I've got a 5-star rating, I'm like, man, that's a cool thing to check off my bucket list.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been reading Dave's newsletter since I was training. The newsletter used to come like on a like typewritten paper. And the Calgary Boxing and Wrestling Commission guy had it. And it'd be almost like, can we see one of those sheets or whatever we used to call them, the rags or whatever it was? So to me, and like you mentioned, like if for people just not understanding a 5-star rating, like I had the match of the year in the Observer versus Shawn Michaels on the ladder match from 2009. That wasn't 5 stars. I had what was voted the greatest Raw match of all time, which was Jericho and Benoit versus Austin and Triple H. That wasn't 5 stars. Now, in my head, they're 5 stars. I don't know how much get much better, but for Dave's rating system, they weren't. So the first 5-star I ever got was Kenny Omega at the Tokyo Dome 2018, and that's like 28 years into the job for me. So for you to get one at 23 years old, like you said, that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it's cool to know that if I never get another 5-star match ever again, I got one.
Yeah.
I got one. It's cool to kind of like get it out of the way a little
bit. Well, like you said, it was our first official kind of 5-way match, and here we are.
Yeah, that's the craziest part. Like, it was our first time as a tag team. We've all been in a match together, and we're 5 stars. Maybe we should just stop now. Maybe we should just be batting 100.
We're done. So tell me about how it was for then as well. So you show up a few days later It was kind of a last-minute decision of Moxley and Danny Garcia. Now, have you main-evented Dynamite before as a single match?
Yeah, so actually, little stat. I've main-evented the most AEW shows in the past year out of anybody.
Really?
Yes, yes. I've main-evented the most AEW shows in the past year out of anybody on the roster.
Who were some of the other main events that you had?
Sammy Guevara, Mox at the United Center, me and you against Reynolds and Silver.
Right.
Yeah, I've had a bunch of them. Me and King on Rampage a couple times.
So how was that for you? Like you said, because we mentioned on the podcast that you kind of came in and you were had a good run in the indies and you didn't know if you wanted to be here. And now that you're here at 23 years old, having the most main events, I mean, that's a pretty big deal too.
Yeah, it feels like a big deal. I'm blown away by the amount of trust that Tony showed in me, like right off the bat. I mean, I got here and I was wrestling Mox at main event in the United Center.
Yeah.
Like a couple weeks into being at AEW.
Right.
And I feel like I was just able to build a lot of trust with him by doing really well in all my performances, to where now we were driving we were driving to LA from Vegas, me, the Blade, and Laura, or the Bunny.
Bunny, yeah.
We were all driving to LA and we're eating at a diner. And I just open up my phone and I'm like, oh, I guess I'm wrestling Mox at the Forum on Wednesday. I just see a tweet from Tony saying Daniel Garcia is wrestling Mox. And I feel like now the trust is very warranted that he has in me, because he knows he gives me something. I'm going to do my best with it and I'm going to do it well. But off the bat, I don't know what he was thinking. I don't know how he had so much trust in me. Like, I had no TV wrestling experience for him to just say, yeah, we're going to put him against all these big stars and big main events.
We know that Tony follows the indies very closely, right?
Yeah.
So, and you mentioned you had a pretty big indie run. So did you have a lot of steam? Like, what companies were you working in that kind of built up where you, like, mentioned you had such a good run?
Yeah, I was wrestling for Beyond, C4 Wrestling, Limitless Wrestling, a lot of, like, the top tier American indies I was wrestling. And I had, like, just gone to Mexico, Puerto Rico. So I was developing a really big run on the indies. Mm-hmm. And I think Tony, he must have a IWTV account where he watches all my matches or something. And he ended up actually texting Pepper and he said, like, hey, Danny Garcia is one of your guys, right? And he was like, and Pepper was like, yeah. So then he said, oh, I want to book him. I want to bring him in. And then that's how I wrestled Sting and King and Darby and Mox in that match at 2.0.
So it was Sting, Darby, and Kingston?
And Mox, Sting at ringside.
Let's talk about that. So you mentioned being in Buffalo, from Buffalo, and so is the Butcher and the Blade, but Pepper is the Blade. So is that that's who was, like, your trainer?
Yeah, so I was trained at a school called Grapplers Anonymous in Lackawanna, New York. It's 2 minutes out from South Buffalo where I live. The gym is a 5-minute drive from my house. And I was trained by a guy named Brandon Thurston and Mikey Every Night. Brandon Thurston is actually the analytical guy, who does all the data.
Gets the data. Oh, yeah. I was wondering. So he used to be a wrestler?
Yeah, he's my original trainer, and a guy named Mikey Every Night. And then I was training there for a little bit, and Pepper ended up coming into the gym like a couple weeks, months since I started training. And he did advanced classes. And I took his advanced classes. He put like a nice polish on all the guys. So he's one of my trainers.
How old were you then?
18, I started.
So were you still in high school, or did you drop out, or how'd you get involved?
I graduated high school, so I was in college during all this stuff. Yeah.
Okay. So was that always something you wanted to do when you were a kid, was get into wrestling?
Yeah, wrestling was something I was always a fan of. I wanted to be a hockey player growing up.
Yeah.
I played hockey my whole life. But obviously you get to an age where you realize I'm never going to be in the NHL.
Yeah.
I'm not good enough to be in the NHL. And
not a lot of Garcias in the NHL.
not a lot of Latino and Hispanic men in the NHL. I feel like wrestling is something that I liked, but I never knew I could do. I never understood, like, man, like, how do I become a wrestler? I was at a local indie show and it was Johnny Gargano against Tony Nese. This company called ESW in Buffalo. And they had a match. And I remember meeting them after the show and standing next to them and being like, man, these guys aren't that much bigger than me.
Right.
Like, I'm taller than these guys. Maybe I could be a wrestler. And one of the local guys at the show, Mikey Every Night, he told me about the school he ran. And then I started training there.
It's interesting. There's always that moment of truth where you go, hold on a second. They're not that big. I remember when I waited in line at the World of Wheels, like in about 1987, to meet Ricky Steamboat. It's a famous picture that I used it when I worked on WrestleMania, where my eyes are kind of closed. It's the typical 16-year-old kid meeting somebody famous. You don't know what to do. And I remember I waited in line for like an hour and a half, and I was just trying to think, what's the best question I could ask him? And what I came up with is, how tall are you? That was all I could ask. And he said he was 5'11", and he's like, 230 pounds. I was like, 5'11"? I'm 5'11". Like, wow, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat's the same height as me. And he's like the best, you know? So you get that moment where it kind of clicks in, where, because there is kind of a common miscommunication that you have to be 6'2" or whatever it may be. But in this day and age, that's not even the case at all, ever.
Yeah, you don't even got to be 6'8". 5'4", 5'8" now, yeah. You could be any size you want. But yeah, it was really interesting because you see people on TV and they look so big. And even at an indie show as a live viewer, they just look so much bigger because you're on an elevated platform under all these lights and stuff. Right. So they look like just like gods almost. Mm-hmm. You're like, man, these people are so big. But then when you meet them at the merch table, you're like, oh man, I'm about 3 inches taller than this guy. Maybe I could become a wrestler.
So did you finish your college, your university?
Yeah, I graduated in May of 2020. I have a degree in communication.
Oh, wow. So you were working already in the business at that point too, though?
Yeah. Both? I was doing the indies and I had a job and I was in college.
Because I had my college degree that I got before. It's actually communications as well. It's called creative communications. But because I was too young to go to wrestling school, you had to be 18. I graduated from high school, I was 17. So I kind of did that for a couple of years to kill some time. But that sort of stuff helps with wrestling, the communication aspect of it.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons why I went for communication is because I remember hearing like you and Edge and talk about how you guys went to college for like broadcasting and communication and stuff like that.
Oh, that's cool.
And I'm like, man, maybe this could help me when I want to become a wrestler.
So there's a lot of kind of indie guys in Buffalo. It seems kind of a hot indie area.
Yeah, it for a while it was like dead. There wasn't a lot of good wrestlers there. But once a couple young guys like me, this guy named Kevin Blackwood, this guy named Puff, Kevin wrestles for like PWG.
Yeah.
He did Dark a couple times.
I think we've seen him here.
Yeah, he did Dark sometimes.
Maybe Puff too, right?
Puff did it too.
I remember Puff.
Puff was the best man for Kip and Penelope's wedding, I think, on the one of the Dynamites, just randomly out of nowhere. But yeah, and Kevin Bennett, once we all started wrestling, the scene kind of like picked up and it was a place that other indie wrestlers wanted to come to. And of course people would book the car and we were kind of known as like the Buffalo guys, the Buffalo brothers.
Yeah.
And we would just be booked and we would like go to all these companies and we're four different wrestlers. So we'd be like a variety on people's shows. It's not like you're booking four of the same wrestler.
Right.
You're booking four completely different people.
So let's talk about this. And this is one of the things that I blew my mind that I didn't put two and two together. And like I said, you never even told me either. But I remember, I guess it was like 2 years ago, and reading that some independent wrestlers were and I'm probably getting this wrong, and you can tell me after, on a car trip, hit some black ice or whatever, slid off the highway and trashed the car and were totally messed up and needed help with their hospital bills. And I'd never met the guys before, never even heard of them before, but I just really like connected with it because we used to get four or five in a car and drive up in northern, you know, in Canada, up in Alberta and in Manitoba. And those roads were very icy too. And there's a few times we were like, whoa, that was close. It could have just as easily went that way for us. So I donated some money. And then years later, I find out that one of those guys was you, Daniel Garcia. And I was like, he never told me. I've talked to this guy like five or six times. We actually used that in our very first Jericho Appreciation Society promo. But kind of tell me about that night, and first of all, why didn't you ever mention it to me that we did that?
Well, I mentioned it to you the first time I was an extra here.
Oh, okay.
I remember me and a couple of the Buffalo guys that were here, we came up and like thanked you for your donation.
Oh, okay,
and
cool.
Stuff like that.
But you were probably just kind of more of a nameless, faceless, dark guy at that
point,
right?
You didn't know who I was at that point.
Right.
But yeah, we were on our way home from a show in Montreal, booked by Carl LeDuc, the guy who got beat up in Wrestling with Shadows by Stu Hart in the dungeon. Alex Abrahantes was also in that scene as well, I found out.
Was he really?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, we were on our way home from a show in Montreal.
What is that, about a 2-hour drive or so? Or
no, Montreal to Buffalo is probably like 6-7 hours.
Okay, I was thinking Albany. Yeah, you gotta go.
Yeah, right. So it's like 4 in the morning. we're about an hour out from home. Like, we were so close to being home. And we've done this drive, like, so many times. We were getting booked in Montreal every single month. And we just hit some black ice. The car spun out, and we crashed right into, like, the end of the guardrail. So the guardrail basically splits the car in
like
half.
Like in a T. So the guardrail is straight, and you guys are hitting it as a T.
Yeah. Form. Or, no, like, we hit it straight. So it went straight through the front of the car.
Oh, my gosh.
Into the back. Yeah,
the actual guardrail went all the way through the car?
Yeah.
It's amazing that you didn't get sliced in two. Who was driving?
One of the Buffalo guys.
Didn't matter.
Me and Blackwood were in the back seat, and we both broke. I broke my femur and my right leg, and my fibia and tibia and my left shin and ankle.
That's unbelievable. So let's go back to this crash. What do you remember about the crash?
I was sleeping in the back, and I remember I woke up, and we were just spinning. And in my mind, like, it feels almost comical now. I was just like, oh, man, like, here we go, like, strap in. And I remember we crashed, and, like, the sound was disgusting. Like, just the ripping through the car, you could, like, hear it. It was nasty. But after the crash, it was almost, like, peaceful. Like, it was, you couldn't hear anything. There was no traffic. There was, like, dew on the ground, because I was able to get to the ground somehow. And I remember just laying there. And I looked up at the front of the car, and I see the people in the front, and Puff is trying to break through the glass window to get out. And I remember it being almost like calming. I was in this exact tone right now, like how I'm talking. This is exactly how I was talking. And Kevin Bennett, he goes, "Daniel, are you okay?" And I went, "Yeah, I'm good. I think I broke both my legs, though." That's exactly how I said it.
You're totally in shock.
Yeah, I was like so at peace, so calm. And I remember it just being so cold out. It's the middle of winter.
What month is it?
January.
Gotcha. Yeah.
It was just freezing. And we couldn't find our phones to call it, like the ambulance. Luckily, Puff found his phone and was able to call. And I remember he was arguing with the paramedics on the phone because they were like just asking for information that was hard for us to get at the time.
Yeah.
Like, what highway are you near? Like, right, what exit are you near?
Yeah.
It's like, we don't know. We think our friend is dead in the back seat.
Was that Blackwood?
Yeah, we thought Blackwood was dead in the backseat.
Was he unconscious?
He's completely knocked out.
Wow.
I'm laying on the grass. I can't move at all, and I think I'm about to get hypothermia. It's so cold. And we were just all in such shock. And luckily, the paramedics come. Now, the thing that made me mad most is the paramedic says, "Well, can you stand up?" And I said, "Oh, I think my legs are broken." And they go, "Well, you got to try." And I'm like, "Oh, how do you want me to try?
Like, sure they're broken.
How do you want me to go about this? I'm pretty sure they're broken." And then I remember we went to the hospital, and my mom showed up, and Pepper showed up, and then I went into surgery.
What was the total? You broke what?
My femur and my right leg, so that's your bone from your hip to your
knee.
That's
the big one, yeah.
Yeah, it's the big one. And then my fibia and my tibia and fibula in my left shin and left ankle.
Wow. So you wake up from surgery, and what's the prognosis?
Ooh, I remember right before I was going into surgery, my mom was with me, and she asked, actually, the doctor. She was like, "Well, do you think he'll ever be able to wrestle again?" And the doctor was so nonchalant. He was like, "Yeah, I think he'll be able to. Like, he should be good." But that was the last thing on my mind. I think my mom thought that was like what I wanted.
The first thing on your mind,
to feel peace, and I have the best mom in the world. You know? But I remember I came out of surgery, and I felt good. I was surrounded by people who loved me. I was surrounded by people who I really cared about and who clearly cared about me, because they're coming to a hospital to see me at my worst. And I remember the first couple days after, I just felt so blessed to be alive and so blessed to have such a good support team around me. I know it sounds corny, but
no,
those moments like that, it really makes you feel grateful for life.
Yeah. So what were the injuries that some of the other guys had?
Kevin broke the same thing in his left ankle, but he didn't break his femur. And I think he had some head trauma as well at first, but he's okay now. Mm. And then Puff and Bennett, who were in the front seats, they were fine, luckily. And I think I remember right after surgery, I said to my mom, I said, "Thank God it was me and Kevin that got hurt," because Kevin Bennett in the front had just had a baby. And then Puff, also in the front, he's a big man. He weighs like 400 pounds. Yeah. So I don't know how he would have recovered. And it would have been bad for Kevin to have to take off work when he just has a newborn baby. And stuff. So thank God it was me and Kevin are the ones that got hurt.
Did you have to do any, like, learning how to walk or anything like that again, or just had to wait for the healing and you were fine?
I had physical therapy and occupational therapy in the hospital, so they had to teach me how to like get on and off the toilet, get out and out of bed, those kind of things.
Gotcha.
Like simple everyday habits. That was the occupational therapy. That was the biggest, the doctor's biggest concern for me to go home.
So when you guys put, I can't remember if it was GoFundMe, I'm assuming, how much did you get from that?
I think the GoFundMe total, I want to say, was like, I think $40,000, something like that.
Were you like blown away by the amount of support that you got?
I was so blown away. I mean, when I saw you donated, like Finn Balor, CM Punk, like these people who, like you said, it could have been anybody.
Yeah.
Everybody knows what it's like to drive. If you're an indie wrestler, you know what it's like to drive, and that could have been anybody. And that's not something that you necessarily think about when you're going on a road trip.
You're right.
For a wrestling show, you're just concerned about, oh man, I hope we get trans money for the show.
Exactly, right.
I hope there's a restaurant open after the show so I don't have to eat McDonald's. You're not worried about, oh man, I hope I make it home alive.
What makes you realize that it can happen so quickly? And it has happened to some of the brothers, Adrian Adonis and Brady Boone, a couple others, but also too that wrestling is such a brotherhood. You know, like you said, guys like Punk or Finn or me, I think Tony might have even donated some. Yeah,
Tony did.
You know, it's just guys that just, like you said, we've all been here before.
Yeah.
And we got lucky and you didn't, so.
Yeah, and I mean, it really was just beautiful to, once I saw, I like opened Twitter, I think, and then I checked the group chat with like my friends, and they were saying, oh, like CM Punk just donated. I'm like, man, that's a cool feeling.
Yeah, that's cool.
Like it made me feel very blessed. Like even the people who had no idea who I was at the time are willing to support me because they know how hard the struggle of wrestling is in general. And then they know the struggle of being in a car accident while you're trying to do what you love on top of that. It was really beautiful for me to see everybody's support.
So how long was it until you got back into the ring again after the crash?
My first match after that, I believe, was June. So I went from January, June. It was against Stu Grayson at C4 Wrestling.
Wow.
It was a pretty quick turnaround time. I don't want to brag, but my surgeon told me that it was the fastest he's seen anybody come back from either of those injuries, let alone both at the same time.
Wow. That's amazing.
I was on some John Cena, Wolverine recovery type stuff.
That is true. Those stories that you heard are exactly true. So let's talk a little bit more about kind of your journey to get to AEW. Now, you mentioned that you had this great indie run. You mentioned you went to Mexico and Puerto Rico. How long were you there? Let's, for example, in Mexico, and what company were you working for there?
Mexico, I only did one show.
Okay.
I just went for like a weekend. It was a show called, it's actually called Lucha Memes, the show was called.
Lucha Memes?
Yeah. And I wrestled this guy named Aramis, who I believe he signed to MLW now. He wrestles for PWG.
Yeah.
And we wrestled, and we had like an American-style super indie match. But I did not realize how hard that ring was going to be.
Yes.
We were doing, like, pile drivers and superplexes, and my elbows are still messed up from wrestling in that Mexican ring, man.
It's amazing. They were shitty, you know, 30 years ago when I was there, and they haven't upgraded them at all.
No wonder why every luchador, they just roll for all their bumps.
Yeah.
Like everything is an arm drag or something like that, because I don't want to bump in that
ring
either.
That's a great point. I remember I wrestled one time with this guy called Fabuloso Blondie. He was kind of a legendary local guy there. Yeah. And I was like, I got this idea. He goes, dude, you're not going to want to take any bumps. Like, and I'm thinking, he's just kind of this old school brother, doesn't want to work hard. I'm like, whatever. I remember he gave me a hip toss, and I was like, holy shit. Like, you're right, dude. Let's just do some roll arounds and a couple, you know, kicks to the face. Let's get out of here.
That was the same thing that happened with me. We had a whole match planned. And I think the first thing I took was like a leg sweep. And I took it and went like, oh, like,
yeah.
I wish we did not call this match.
So most of those types of matches, you're just going in for one-offs. It wasn't like you were there. Like, for example, like I lived in Mexico for a year or whatever. Maybe you never did anything like that?
No, I never had the chance to do anything like that. Yeah.
Gotcha. Did you ever have any time with WWE in any way, shape, or form? I know you did.
But. Yeah. So I did, I think a year into wrestling, I did extra work for WWE. And I wrestled Drew Gulak on 205 Live.
Oh, wow.
In like a 15-second match, I think.
Really?
Yeah. And he beat me up pretty bad. It was pretty nasty, pretty ruthless. And then I had a WWE tryout in January of last year, so 2021. and I had a match on NXT right after the tryout.
So was that after you'd already been kind of working here for a bit in Darks or whatever?
Yeah, I did one loop of Dark in September of 2020. And then I had my tryout in January of 2021.
Now, is this one of those tryouts where you go to the performance center, they make you do 100 rolls and bumps and barrel rolls and all
yes,
that shit?
Yes, yes. So many burpees to show that I'm a good wrestler.
So, and what did they say to you when the camp was done?
Yeah, so I did the camp, and honestly, I crushed it. Like, the promo was phenomenal. Well, I thought it was at the time. Yeah. Looking back, probably it wasn't.
But you had confidence in it, though.
Yeah, like at the time, I liked it. And I had a really good practice match against, it was only me, one other indie guy, and then like a bunch of football players.
Yeah, of course. Because if you want to be a wrestler, how dare you actually go to become an independent wrestler?
Go foul at another sport if you want exactly. to become a wrestler. But yeah, and I thought I did really well. They asked me to stay another extra day. To go to have a squash match on NXT against Tyler Rust, his name was, in Diamond Mine Thrigstrone. And the match went really well. I remember I went through the back, and like Shawn Michaels loved it, and Road Dogg loved it, A-Train loved it. Triple H shook my hand and said, welcome to the team.
Really?
So, and I think he thought I was signed, but like I wasn't at the time.
Oh.
But in my mind, I'm like, oh, like I guess I'm going to NXT.
Right.
Mom, I'm moving to Orlando. And I talked to Canyon Seaman right before I left. And he said, hey, like, let me know if any other place has interest. Because we'll sign you sooner. And in my mind, I'm like, that's disrespectful to me.
Big time, yeah.
Like, if you want to sign me, just sign me. And then I remember, I was like, okay, he wants to play that. I'll play it back to him. He said, so if you're going to sign anywhere else, talk to us sooner. And at the time, I had, like, interest from Ring of Honor. And, I knew AEW wanted to bring me back in for like extra work, but I was like, I'm going to make this seem bigger than it actually is. So I said to him, well, with that being said, I'll talk to you very soon. And I think he got kind of hot at me for that.
Right.
I think they shook him up a little bit. And they emailed me a couple weeks later kind of saying like, oh, like we're going to stay in contact, blah, blah, blah. And then that kind of made me mad. And then I went on a crazy indie run and then I signed with AEW.
You know, it's funny to me, like, when you hear those stories, and you're kind of, like, maybe a little bit shorter than what the prototype is, but you're 23, got experience, good-looking guy, you can talk, you can wrestle, and they're like, well, if anyone else calls you, let us know. I don't get it. Like, it's actually, somebody pointed out, it might have even been Dave in the review of the Anarchy in the Arena, it's like 3/5 of our team... Matt and Angelo got fired from WWE after never really getting to do anything. And you had a tryout and didn't even get picked up. And it's just like, and here we are main eventing, you know, this pay-per-view and having these great matches. And it's interesting.
It's insane. Because I remember, well, Regal actually just did an interview the other day where he said, I think the time that I did the tryout, the things were already being put into place where NXT was going to change.
Right.
Like they weren't super interested in indie wrestlers anymore.
Gotcha.
Regal just did an interview the other day where he said he wanted to sign me, Yuta, and Ricky Starks while he was still there.
All three of those guys.
Yeah.
All three of you guys had tryouts.
Yeah. And he said he wanted to sign all three of us, but NXT just changed so quickly
right.
that he wasn't able to get us in. But I think it's for the best.
Yeah, well, I think it worked out.
I think it's for the best.
So tell me a little bit more about this great indie run that you had. Why do you call it a great indie run?
I think indie wrestling is in a very different place than it was 2 years ago.
Right.
And when I blew up in indie wrestling, we didn't have any stars left, you know, because AEW came about, Ring of Honor started signing people. A couple years ago on the indies, there was people, you had like Gargano, Ciampa, Sami Callihan. Those people got signed.
Yeah.
But then it's like we had MJF left, Sammy Guevara, Brody King. We had like still names left. And then all of a sudden NXT starts signing all these indie guys. AEW comes about. They sign all the indie guys. Ring of Honor is signing people to contracts again.
All the UK indie guys are signed over there.
Yeah. And then I remember a group of us on the indies, like the people that were left, like me, Wheeler Yuta, Lee Moriarty, Kevin Blackwood, were kind of looking around like, man, we're the only ones left. We're probably the best wrestlers here. And part of us, I feel like we didn't feel ready at the time. We were like, man, I'm not ready to like be main eventing shows, even though it's a little indie show.
Right.
I don't feel ready to be in these spots. And I think it was kind of cool because we all kind of had to grow together.
Ah.
We didn't really have people who could teach us. We didn't have legends that we could wrestle like Chris Hero. We didn't have experiences to wrestle Roger Strong. We didn't have opportunities to wrestle people who could really teach us. So right. We had to learn from each other and grow together. And once we all got to the point where we were pretty good, I feel like nobody could touch our little group on the indies. And then I think soon after that, that's when everyone started to catch wind of it. Like me and Yuta both got tryouts at the same time, like about the same time. We started wrestling for New Japan Strong at the same time.
Oh, okay.
And I think everyone started to catch wind of us once we were all able to grow into ourselves.
Right.
And we did it really independently, which I think was really cool.
Well, I mean, that's kind of how our generation of guys did it too, because there was no... You know, it was a lot harder to kind of get on TV back then because, you know, like, how do we even get to WWE? And plus, you talk about guys being bigger. They all were bigger then. So what we had to do is kind of go international, Japan and Mexico. For me, it was Mexico, then Japan, and find the places where they didn't care about size as much. They just cared about the quality of wrestling. So it's interesting how every generation has the guy. You stick together with your boys. You know what I mean? And that's cool. That's, you know,
it felt really cool. Just like I said, we didn't have any role models left on the indies.
Yeah.
We didn't have people that we could wrestle and learn and become great from. So we had to do it with each other.
When you started kind of thinking about AEW and you're working here a bit, and then so you kind of mentioned it on our last podcast with the Jericho Appreciation Society, but how did you end up finally deciding to come to AEW? Because at first you're a little hesitant, it seemed.
Yeah, so they had reached out to me to do extra work for the Double or Nothing pay-per-view last year.
Which
is in Jacksonville, yes. It was like the first like show again with like a lot of
with
fans,
crowd,
I think.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time, I had just did it in May. And the experience for me, personally, it didn't feel great. I really enjoyed the extra work the first time I did it at AEW. But the second time around I did it, I just, it was kind of like whatever.
Yeah.
Respectfully, I felt like I had kind of outgrown an extra work role. And then they reached out to me to do it again for the Double or Nothing pay-per-view. And I was just kind of over it. I said no. I turned it down. And then in July, I had a crazy week lined up. I had this, it's a technical wrestling tournament in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's called SCI. A lot of big names have done it, like Chris Hero, Matt Riddle.
Right.
It's like a pretty big indie thing, especially in the South. I had that lined up, and I had the IWTV title match with Yuta lined up, where we did an hour-long draw, which is critically acclaimed.
That's a critically
acclaimed match. And it's like on list for like best matches of the year, like almost on every list.
That's great.
And I had that week lined up, and then Tony had texted Pepper and asked if I could come in. And in my mind, I remember I was sitting in the living room with my mom when I got this text. I said, Mom, do you think I should go? And she was like, yeah, you have a crazy week anyways. You might as well just go do it. And I said, fine, I'll fly out to Jacksonville. And so I went, and that's when I found out I was doing that crazy match with 2.0. I met 2.0 for the first time.
That quickly?
Yeah, man. I think I got home on a Monday, and then I had to fly out the next day to get to Jacksonville.
To wrestle with Mox and King and Darby. It's amazing that's the thing about wrestling. You always have momentum and you can feel it, but it's like, when am I going to get my break? When am I going to get a break? And finally, what happens, and it goes fast after that.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in not chasing things but attracting things.
Oh.
And I feel like for a while in my wrestling career, I was really focused on, oh man, I need a WWE contract, or I need to get to Ring of Honor, I need to get to AEW. And once I felt like I had enough freedom in myself to say, man, maybe I don't need these things right now. Like, I can have patience, and I know it will come when the time is right.
Yeah.
I think, like, a couple months after I had started feeling like that, that's when the big break came.
That's when it comes, right?
And I felt like I was ready for it. I think if it came any sooner, maybe I wouldn't have been ready for it.
Right.
So I really think it came at the perfect time for me.
Let's talk a little bit about your style. Something else that you said on the podcast, I just listened back to it yesterday, or whatever it was, where you said, like, people think I'm just this technical wrestler, but I mean, obviously you have a lot of different sides to you. You can brawl, which we just saw. You have some, we're not high flyers in the sense of the word of high flyers now, but you can still do a pile driver off the apron onto the steps and take some of the bumps that you took. The bump you took on the stairs with Mox was absolutely insane. And I consider that high flying as well, because it's very daredevil. What is your style? What did you pattern it after? Because you also exchanged some great holds with Mox that I've never been able to do.
Dude, I like to describe my style as like emotional wrestling. I love making people feel. I think a lot of people at a surface level see my wrestling and it's just like, oh, he does some submission holds.
Right.
But to me, it's so much more than that. That's just my way of, that's the best way I can portray my feelings and my emotions and my struggle to a crowd. I think the best way I can connect with the crowd is by portraying struggle. And that's why I chose to do things with holds, because I think that's the best way I could show it. It's not easy connecting with the crowd, I don't think, especially when you're just too focused on moves,
right,
and too focused on your spots and too focused on remembering matches. I think it's very hard to connect with the crowd. But submissions are something that I'm very comfortable with. So when I'm on the mat and I'm just kind of exchanging holds, I can kind of be in the moment and not have to focus on doing anything too high risk,
right,
or have to focus on doing anything that I'm not comfortable with. Oh. And I feel like that's where I can really connect with the crowd the most.
It's very smart. It's very, very astute thinking. And that's the thing that I like, that now that I got to know you, you're a very deep thinking guy, you know, and that's important. That's, Swerve Strickland was like that too. His thoughts on wrestling were different from the norm. And that shows that you have a different kind of feel for it.
And I've always, since I started wrestling, I never wanted to be a guy who the crowd reacts to me because they feel like they need to react to whatever I'm doing. Like, I don't want people to be like, oh, now is the time to clap, so I guess we're going to clap. Now is the time to chant, so now we're going to chant. I want people to react to me because they feel it. I want people to, even if they don't want to cheer or boo me, they feel like they have to. I want it to be a guttural feeling in themselves where they're not just playing along with the crowd,
right,
or playing along with the show. I want them to either love me truly or hate me truly. I don't want it to be, oh, now's the time to clap. Let's clap. Yeah. Hey, this is awesome. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I would rather prefer guttural, real reactions from people,
yeah, actual,
than a circadian rhythm, you know?
Had you done any live promos in AEW before our first one in San Antonio?
I did a bunch of the Rampage 3 boxes,
right,
but I don't think I've ever done a live promo.
How was that for you?
Ooh, I remember I was nervous.
Yeah.
Like, going out, I felt fine, but once I knew my line was coming up, my hands, like, went numb. Like, my hands felt all tingly. Like, I remember Edge talked about his match with Undertaker at WrestleMania. He said he couldn't feel his hands beforehand.
Yeah.
Before the match when he was doing his entrance. And that's how I felt out there. I was like, okay, my line's coming up. This is a big moment for our whole group. It's kind of like, the group wouldn't be over if we messed up that segment, but I know this is the first time we're being seen. Like, it's kind of, right, it's kind of do or die. So I knew I had to deliver it to the best of my abilities, and my hands were just so numb. Like, I remember I could barely feel my hands at all. And then once I delivered the line, I was like, okay, I feel good now.
You did it, yeah.
I can kind of be, I can relax a little bit.
Well, you did a great job with it too. Now, we talked a little bit about this, but did you get a lot of flack from the sports entertainer thing? Because you're the wrestler guy?
Yeah, a lot of people online were just so mad at me, like, Daniel, how could you? You shouldn't join Chris Jericho. You should join Bryan Danielson. Yeah. Like, it's like I can just go backstage and be like, look, Chris, the fans want me to join Bryan. I got to go.
Okay, man. Well, that's okay. That's cool. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I got a lot of hate for that, but I think it was good. It's good to show people a different side of me.
Absolutely.
And I think going with Bryan would have been just such a easy route. An easy path for my career. You know, I don't like easy paths. I like doing things that people don't see coming.
Sure.
And I like surprising people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned that you met 2.0 for the first time when you were about to have this huge match. Like, once again, we're all actors, and I'm sure when you sign on for a movie, you don't have years of experience with your co-star, but once again, that's another huge night for you guys. Did the three of you guys sit down at any point and go like, all right, guys, we got to kill this, or... Was there any camaraderie there?
I feel like off the bat, I was kind of like, who are these goofballs, man? Like I was like, I'm the best indie wrestler in the world. Why am I tagging with these two
these
people
guys,
who just got fired from NXT, these comedy guys? But definitely right off the bat, there was chemistry. I think at first I was a little nervous because Matt is such a ball of stress at all times. And I felt like it was like rubbing off on me. I just want to be like, man, like, you need to calm down. You're about to give me a panic attack before this match. But I think right off the bat, there was definitely chemistry, especially when we made our entrance. I was like, okay, this kind of feels right. And then after the match and then the next coming weeks, like, we just had each other's backs and we had a group chat and we were, like, jokes were flying and flowing. It just felt very natural to the point where I remember we did the United Center. And this is probably, I've known them for a month at this point when I did the United Center. And I wrestled Mox. And I remember I was making my way back up the ramp. And we were kind of just looking around, taking it all in. And I remember I said to him, guys, I know I've only known you guys for a couple weeks. And I was about to say, but I love you guys. And before I could even get it out, they kind of cut me off. And they're like, don't even say it, man. We love you too. We love you too. And I think that's the moment where I was like, these people are going to be in my life forever.
Yeah.
No matter what happens.
Yeah,
I'm going to be with these guys forever.
So you're still wrestling in indies now, and you're the current PWG champ, which is a huge deal. And I remember as soon as I saw that match, I said to Tony, like, he's got to win. He has to win this. So and you did, which is great. So kind of talk about that. Had you worked PWG many times prior?
So I didn't wrestle for PWG until I assigned to AEW.
Oh, okay.
The first time I wrestled in PWG was October of 2021, so a couple months ago.
Right.
I did that show, and then I did Bola, where I won the tournament.
All right.
And then I wrestled for the title, and then I won it from Bandido. So my career at PWG has been pretty short far, but I'm planning on being there for a while.
So how was the match with Bandido?
It was fun, man. Bandido, he didn't show up until about 20 minutes before it was time to go out to wrestle. But we went and we did the best match that I think we could have for that night. And it was definitely a cool moment for me to, Brian Danielson, Kenny Omega, Davey Richards, so many great names have held this title.
Yeah.
People who I look up to, Kyle O'Reilly, Adam Cole. So I feel like it's going to be cool to look back at the lineage after my career is over. It'll be even cooler to look back at the lineage to be like, I want someone to win that title who is a 23-year-old 15 years from now and be like, man, this was Daniel Garcia's title. That's how I want people to feel. Like, man, I can't believe I'm holding Daniel Garcia's belt. That's how I want people to feel.
Do you still do a lot of indies, though, on the weekends?
I don't really do a lot anymore. I was kind of told to slow down a little bit. So I really only do PWG, New Japan Strong, which isn't really an indie. And then I do Defy every once in a while.
Have you been international at all?
No, I want to so bad, though, because I didn't blow up on the indies until pandemic.
Right.
So I couldn't go to the UK or Ireland or Japan or anything like that. So I pretty much had to stay in America. But I've done Canada a bunch, too, which I guess is technically international.
Technically, yeah.
But not really. You know, I can cross the border in 5 minutes from my house, so not really too international.
How was that for you when the pandemic hit? Because like we said, the independent wrestling was super hot. Lots going on, and then like so many guys just lost everything over the course of a month, because at least like for us here, we were under contract, which is great. Wrestled in front of no people, which we'll talk about, but at least we knew we still had a paycheck coming in. Indie guys did not.
Yeah, it was kind of like a reset. It felt like indie wrestling. Someone pressed a button, and then it was like, okay, now it's fair game. Like, we're going to see who really rises from this. And I think the people who rose from it were me, Yuta, Lee, Blackwood, kind of our crop of guys. I think we were all able to kind of stand the test of time. And we were doing shows in front of no crowd. And I think we're all talented enough to still put on good matches in a vacuum where there's no crowd interaction or anything like that. And I think a lot of people were really impressed by our ability to do that, to captivate a viewing audience without a live audience actually there.
Yeah, I remember thinking like someone was like, oh my gosh, I feel so bad for the young guys with no crowd. And I was like, the young guys, I feel bad for me.
Yeah.
Working in front of thousands of people since I was a teenager. What the hell am I supposed to do? It was such a weird time though.
Yeah, like, how did you feel during all that?
I couldn't, like, I remember I was working with Orange and he was like, did I sell that too long? And I was like, I don't know. If there's no crowd, I don't know how to gauge anything. Yeah. I don't know what to do. You know what I mean? And it was really strange. And I remember when the people started coming back, I was like, am I still going to be over? Like, who knows? None of us really knew for sure what was going down, you know? So it was very strange.
Isn't it crazy how long ago that feels too? And now we're just doing like,
I know,
16,000 people are doing this, you know?
I mean, it was a experience that we all shared. I think it was good in the long run as far as being a versatile performer. But I don't ever want to do that again.
No.
You know?
The bumps hurt so much more. In front of no people.
Outside, it was either like 100 degrees or it was 35 degrees or whatever it was in the amphitheater, you know?
Yeah, a couple of those Jacksonville tapings I did were brutal.
Yeah.
The days were so long, man. It's so hot in the beginning of the day.
Yeah.
And it's freezing at night. You're there till 2 o'clock in the morning. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So as we start to wind down here, let's talk about some of your matches that you've had in AEW. Because there's been some great ones, and you mentioned some of these great guys you've been in the ring with. What would have been some of the opponents that you enjoyed being in there with?
People who, when I started wrestling, I never would have imagined that I would have shared a ring with. CM Punk.
Right.
Bryan Danielson, Chris Jericho.
Yeah.
Even people like Eddie Kingston. Like, I thought that our paths were so differing. I didn't think I was going to be wrestling someone like that, who was a couple indie generations before me. I'm probably missing some. I feel like there's...
Did you work with Punk?
Yeah, I had a match with Punk on Rampage. Yeah.
How was that?
Oh, it was a blast, man. He's the best. One of the best ever, man. Wrestling him, it's so easy when you wrestle these top guys, man. Especially because you never have to worry about there being a reaction. Because I go out there and wrestle Punk, we don't have to do anything.
Right.
He's over. The crowd is going to be... And that was like his third match back.
Yeah.
The crowd's going to be going crazy regardless. I don't need to do anything.
That's right.
Too out of the ordinary to get the crowd going. They're already going to be into it. So I feel like I get nervous about wrestling like on dark. Like a random guy in dark, because I have to worry about crowd reaction and stuff
right.
But when I'm in the ring with people who have been over for 15, 20 years, I never have to worry about a crowd reaction at all, because I know they're going to carry most of the weight in that sense.
But that's the true story of what pro wrestling is. And when you're, it's great that you realize that being as young as you are, because I remember wrestling, it was probably summer of 92, so I was probably 21, and Nick Bockwinkel was like the special commentator, whatever it was. And he was like, you move too fast, you do too many moves, you know, you don't have to do so much. And I remember thinking, like, and everybody thinks this way, like, what does he know?
Of course.
You know, and then how years later you realize, like, he's totally right. That's the beauty of wrestling. Having the crowd reaction and the story is way more important than any moves you could ever do.
Yes, yes. And I feel like there definitely is a time and place to like, kind of give it your all. And I'm not saying like we take the night, people who are over take the night off or anything.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes when it's two young guys aren't too known by the crowd, maybe that's best to kind of do some crazy stuff to get the crowd going.
Right.
But when I'm in there with Punk or you or Brian, I realize the crowd is going to be going bananas regardless of what we do. They're going to react to a shoulder tackle the same way they react to a Canadian destroyer.
Well, yeah, and like you said, and that's one thing I love about having our faction is that you guys are getting to experience that, like just walking out there and just being like I said, high school bullies, you know, slapping papers out of people's hands and all that stuff. That's to me is just as fun that any match you could ever have.
The promos that we do are just as fun as wrestling to me.
Yeah,
you know, I love doing those promos and the backstage stuff, throwing fireballs, because that's the stuff that I grew up watching. You know. Like, I did grow up watching New Japan as I got older and stuff. But when I was a kid, I was watching Ruthless Aggression era WWE. Like, I was seeing dumb stuff on TV every single week. So that I'm kind of glad I get to do some,
right,
not comedic stuff, but stuff that isn't just, we're going to have this banger wrestling match.
Yeah.
Stuff that's entertaining for a TV crowd.
Did you go to the matches when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. I used to hang out behind the arena. I was one of those kids, yeah.
What was it called? The Marine Midland Arena in Buffalo, what's it called?
Buffalo, it's changed all the time. It was first Niagara Center.
Niagara Center, yeah.
What was it before? HSBC Arena?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet any of the guys when you were hanging out back?
Yeah, I got some great pictures. I got one with Lillian Garcia. I got one with Layla, I think Santino Marella, Dolph Ziggler. I met some good ones back then.
It's such a great wrestling city, Buffalo is.
Yeah, I think every time like WWE goes there, it still sells out.
Yeah.
We're one of the best markets for wrestling.
We had my dad, when I was in WCW, they brought him in. I was like this, you know, the cowardly whining guy.
and he was in Buffalo, and he was like, you know, look at the names from the rafters, like French Connection, Timmy Horton. I played with Timmy Horton. You don't match up to any of these guys. Uh-huh. You're an embarrassment to the family. I just remember that was in that arena there in Buffalo.
Yeah, Buffalo is a great wrestling town, man. Even the indie scene, we have like a couple, for not a huge city, we have a couple big indie promotions that draw like 500 people every month.
Do you talk still, I'm sure you do, to Puff and Blackwood?
Oh, yeah.
Are they happy for you?
They're very happy for me, yeah. And I'm very happy for their success as well. Like, being able to wrestle Kevin Blackwood in the Battle of Los Angeles for PWG was a great moment. That was one of the coolest things I've done in wrestling so far.
So last couple questions for you. So now that you're here, what's kind of your overall goal in AEW?
Yeah, I want to go down as one of the greatest sports entertainers, wrestlers of all time. I think I want to be in the conversation once I retire. Even if I'm not like a consensus greatest of all time, I want it to, when people talk about, if there's like a roundtable discussion, when they're saying like, man, we got to talk about who's the greatest of all time, I want to at least be in the conversation. I want someone to bring my name up. That's my goal. You know, I want to be a multi-time world champion. I want to give people moments to remember that they're going to tell their kids about. Like, oh, like if a dad is watching, sees his kid watching wrestling, I want them to come in and be like, oh, I used to watch Daniel Garcia beat up John Moxley at the Forum. Like, I want people to talk about me in the same light that they talk about people like you, or they talk about Triple H or Brian. I want to be remembered is the main goal.
What do you think you have, what do you have to continue to do, and what do you have to work on to get to that point?
I think I have a lot to work on, you know. I think I need more reps. I think I was getting a lot of reps on the indies, and now, obviously, you can't. There's only so much TV time every single week.
Right.
It's not like you can go out and wrestle for 20 minutes and work the crowd and do all these things like I was able to do on the indies. So I would like to get more reps. I would like to get more high-level reps against people who can teach me, like you and Punk and Brian. And I think some pay-per-view matches where I don't have to worry too much about time and stuff like that. I think those are going to be the things that are going to take me to the next level.
It's interesting for a young guy, because like you said, when I was your age, like, you were always working. I would work 10 matches a week in Mexico, or you'd go to Japan and do a 3-week tour with, you know, 6 shows a week, basically. And you're always working. Hamburg, I worked 36 nights straight, working. Is that a little bit hard to just work every once in a while?
Yeah, because I feel like you kind of get into a rhythm, right?
Yeah.
Where you feel on. And then sometimes I feel like at AEW, it's like not playing a whole NBA season.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, you got to go play game 7 in the finals right now.
like you did on Wednesday.
Yeah, yeah. That's what it feels like sometimes. And I always feel ready. Like, I still train, and I have a lot of faith in my cardio, and I have a lot of faith in myself as a performer to where I know I'm going to deliver. But sometimes I feel like if I had a little bit more reps, maybe I'd be a little bit sharper with some things.
You would do great if you did like Best of Super Junior, or if you did G1. Is that kind of one of your goals to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I was kind of offended that they didn't hit me up for Best of Super Juniors this year. I thought...
But if you were there, you wouldn't have been in the Anakin Arena. That's probably the reason why, to be honest with you.
I was offended.
Were you really?
Yeah, when you would have got announced. And I was like, they didn't hit up Daniel Garcia to be Best of the Super Juniors. But I think they're just saving me for the G1, to be honest. Well, they're probably saving me.
But honestly, too, like I said, we had so much stuff going on. I would have had to kibosh it.
Exactly.
You'd be mad
at me. But I wanted...
At least the offer.
You could have at least reached out.
Yeah, you know?
I felt a little bit slighted.
Yeah.
You know? But I'm also somebody where sometimes I feel like I need to carry a chip on my shoulder in order to be the best version of myself. Yeah. So I feel like that's going to be some good motivation for the next couple months.
You have to have a little bit of chip in your shoulder. You have to be a little bit of an asshole. Yeah. Not in a bad way, but you have to have a little bit of fire inside of you.
Definitely.
You know?
Definitely.
Last question for you. What's your favorite match that you ever had?
Ooh, my favorite match I've ever had. It might be a little bit of recency bias, but Anarchy in the Arena is definitely up there. I feel like my top 3 matches are probably that I've had that I enjoy. Are me and Yuta, hour-long match last summer, Anarchy in the Arena, and that Mox one, man, that might be my best singles match ever, the one I just had on Wednesday.
I'd vouch for that.
That might be my best match ever.
And yeah,
two of those matches happened within a week span of each other.
See what happens? You would have been a best of Super Junior. Except
you're right.
We were looking for Wheeler. He's like, he's not back yet. So everything works out the way it's supposed to.
Everything always works out the way it's supposed to. Every single time.
Who are you looking forward to working with here that you haven't worked with yet?
I want to wrestle Brian again, man. I want to wrestle Brian with more time.
Yeah.
And more freedom.
How did you like wrestling with him? Because you mentioned he was your favorite wrestler ever. Yeah.
It was cool, man. I mean, that was another one. I didn't find out I was wrestling him until an hour before the show started. That's when I was like, oh, I guess I'm wrestling my favorite wrestler of all time tonight. The man I almost cried watching win the world title in my living room. I would like to wrestle him again. Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly are two people I would love to wrestle. I think me and Kyle O'Reilly would put on a crazy match. Samoa Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's tons of people that I still got to get my hands on here.
Well, Danielson, how did you kind of differentiate that? Because you mentioned like, okay, here I am, Brian Danielson, favorite wrestler, crying, but I got an hour to now try and beat the crap out of this guy.
Yeah, I kind of preferred that I didn't know about it because it didn't give me a time to overthink it for a week. I kind of got to the show. They're like, you're wrestling Brian. I'm like, okay, let's do it. Like, I don't got no time to think about
right.
it. Might as well just do it. Yeah, and I kind of prefer it that way sometimes.
Yeah. Well, dude, it's great having you on the squad. And we're 5 stars, baby, like you said.
5 stars, man.
We're the 5-star sports entertainers now.
Appreciate us.
And the fact that we wore the Kangol hats
yes.
specifically because you started it.
Yes,
that's
yes.
your influence already.
The influencer, that's what they should call me, man.
Thanks, dude.
Thanks, Chris.